Daddy, I didn't sneeze in the mountains.
Michael's attention was fixed on Dusty. How about that? He said. Melanie regained her composure. As Michael bent to put Dusty down on the couch, she stooped over the disk drive and slid the disk into the slot. The machine whirred softly and drew it in like a snake eating a rat.
You didn't sneeze? Michael said to Dusty. Not once? Uh-uh.
Melanie straightened up. Michael had not seen what she did. Priest closed his eyes. The relief was overwhelming. They had got away with it. They had Michael's data, and he would never know. Michael said, "That dog doesn't make you sneeze?"
"No, Spirit is a clean dog. Priest makes him wash in the stream, and then he comes out and shakes himself, and it's like a rainstorm."
Dusty laughed with pleasure as he remembered.
"Is that right?" his father said.
Melanie said, "I told you, Michael." Her voice sounded shaky, but Michael did not seem to notice. All right," he said in a conciliatory tone. "If it makes such a difference to Dusty's health, we'll just have to work something out." She looked relieved.
"Thanks."
Priest allowed himself the ghost of a smile. It was all over. His plan had moved another crucial step forward. Now they just had to hope that Michael's computer did not crash. If that happened, and he tried to retrieve his data from the optical disk, he would discover that it was blank. But Melanie said that crashes were rare. In all probability, there would be no crash today, and tonight the computer would back up again, overwriting the blank disk with Michael's data. By this time tomorrow, it would be impossible to tell that a switch had been made. Michael said, "Well, at least he came here to talk about it. I appreciate that." Melanie would much rather have dealt with her husband on the phone, Priest knew, but her move to the commune was a perfect pretext for visiting Michael. He and Melanie could never have paid a casual social call on her husband without making him suspicious, but this way it would not occur to Michael to wonder why they had come. In fact, Michael was not the suspicious type, Priest felt sure. He was brainy but guileless. He had no ability to look beneath the surface and see what was really going on in the heart of another human being. Priest himself had that ability in spades. Melanie was saying, "I'll bring Dusty to see you as often as you like. I'll drive down." Priest could see into her heart. She was being nice to Michael, now that he had given her what she wanted. She had her head to one side, and she was smiling prettily at him. But she did not love him, not any more. Michael was different. He was angry with her for leaving him, that was clear. But he still cared for her. He was not over her yet, not quite. A part of him still wanted her back. He would have asked her, but he was too proud. Priest felt jealous. "I hate you, Michael."
Chapter 4 Judy woke up early on Tuesday, wondering if she had a job. Yesterday she had said, "I quit." But she had been angry and frustrated. Today she was sure she did not want to leave the FBI. The prospect of spending her life defending criminals instead of catching them depressed her. Had she changed her mind too late? Last night she had left a note on Brian Kincaid's desk. Would he accept her apology, or would he insist on her resignation? Pho came in at 6 a.m., and she warmed up some pho, the noodle soup that the Vietnamese ate for breakfast. Then she dressed in her smartest outfit, a dark blue Armani suit with a short skirt. On a good day, it made her sophisticated, authoritative, and sexy all at the same time. "If I'm going to be fired, I might as well look like someone they'll miss." She was stiff with tension as she drove to work. She parked in the garage beneath the federal building and took the elevator to the FBI floor. She went straight to the Sachs office. Brian Kincaid was behind the big desk, wearing a white shirt with red suspenders. He looked up at her. "Good morning," he said coldly. Her mouth was dry. She swallowed and started again.
"Good morning, Brian. Did you get my note?"
"Yes, I did." Obviously, he wasn't going to make this any easier for her. She could not think what else to say, so she simply looked at him and waited. Eventually, he said, "Your apology is accepted." She felt weak with relief.
"Thank you."
You can move your personal stuff into the domestic terrorism squad room.
Okay.
There were worse fates, she reflected. There were several people she liked in the DT squad. She began to relax. Kincaid said, Get to work on the Hammer of Eden case right away. We need something to tell the governor.
Judy was surprised. You're seeing the governor?
His cabinet secretary.
He checked a note on his desk.
A Mr. Albert Honeymoon.
I've heard of him.
Honeymoon was the governor's right-hand man. The case had taken on a higher profile, Judy realized. Let me have a report by tomorrow night. That hardly gave her time to make progress, given how little she had to begin with. Tomorrow was Wednesday.
But the deadline is Friday.
The meeting with Honeymoon is on Thursday.
I'll get you something concrete to give him.
You can give it to him yourself. Mr. Honeymoon insists on seeing what he calls the person at the sharp end. We need to be at the governor's office in Sacramento at 12 noon.
Wow, okay.
Any questions?
She shook her head. I'll get right on it.
As she left, she felt elated that she had her job back, but dismayed by the news that she had to report to the governor's aide. It was not likely she would catch the people behind the threat in only 2 days, so she was almost doomed to report failure. She emptied her desk in the Asian Organized Crime Squad and carried her stuff down the corridor to domestic terrorism. Her new supervisor, Matt Peters, allocated her a desk. She knew all the agents, and they congratulated her on the Fung brothers' case, though in subdued tones. Everyone knew she had fought with Kincaid yesterday. Peters assigned a young agent to work with her on the Hammer of Eden case. He was Raja Khan, a fast-talking Hindu with an MBA. He was 26. Judy was pleased. Although inexperienced, he was intelligent and keen. She briefed him on the case and sent him to check out the Green California campaign. Be nice, she told him. Tell them we don't believe they're involved, but we have to eliminate them.
What am I looking for?
A couple, a blue-collar man of about 45, who may be illiterate, and an educated woman of about 30, who is probably dominated by the man. But I don't think you'll find them there. That would be too easy.
Alternatively?
The most useful thing you can do is get the names of all the officers of the organization, paid or volunteer, and run them through the computer to see if any of them have any record of criminal or subversive activity.
You got it, Raja said. What will you do?
I'm going to learn about earthquakes. Judy had been in one major earthquake. The Santa Rosa earthquake had caused damage worth $6 million, not much as these things go, and had been felt over the relatively small area of 12,000 square miles. The Maddox family was then living in Marin County, north of San Francisco, and Judy was in first grade. It was a minor tremor, she knew now. But at the time she had been 6 years old, and it had seemed like the end of the world. First there was a noise like a train, but real close, and she came awake fast and looked around her bedroom in the clear light of dawn, searching for the source of the sound, scared to death. Then the house began to shake. Her ceiling light with its pink-fringed shade whipped back and forth. On her bedside table, Best Fairy Tales leaped up in the air like a magic book and came down open at Tom Thumb, the story Beau had read her last night. Her hairbrush and her toy makeup set danced on the formica top of the dresser. Her wooden horse rocked furiously with no one on it. A row of dolls fell off their shelf as if diving into the rug, and Judy thought they had come alive like toys in a fable. She found her voice at last and screamed once, Daddy! From the next room she heard her father curse, then there was a thud as his feet hit the floor. The noise and the shaking grew worse, and she heard her mother cry out. Beau came to Judy's door and turned the handle, but it would not open. She heard another thud as he shouldered it, but it was stuck. Her window smashed, and shards of glass fell inward, landing on the chair where her school clothes were neatly folded, ready for the morning. Gray skirt, white blouse, green V-neck sweater, navy blue underwear, and white socks. The wooden horse rocked so hard it fell over on top of the dollhouse, smashing the miniature roof. And Judy knew the roof of her real house might be smashed as easily. A framed picture of a rosy-cheeked Mexican boy came off its hook on the wall, flew through the air, and hit her head. She cried out in pain. Then her chest of drawers began to walk. It was an old bow-fronted pine chest her mother had bought in a junk shop and painted white. It had three drawers, and it stood on short legs that ended in feet like lion's paws. At first it seemed to dance in place, restlessly on its four feet. Then it shuffled from side to side like someone hesitating nervously in a doorway. Finally it started to move toward her. She screamed again. Her bedroom door shook as Beau tried to break it down. The chest inched across the floor toward her. She hoped maybe the rug would halt its advance, but the chest just pushed the rug with its lion's paws. Her bed shook so violently that she fell out. The chest came within a few inches of her and stopped. The middle drawer came open like a wide mouth ready to swallow her. She screamed at the top of her voice. The door shattered, and Beau burst in. Then the shaking stopped. 30 years later, she could still feel the terror that had possessed her like a fit as the world fell apart around her. She had been frightened of closing the bedroom door for years afterward, and she was still scared of earthquakes. In California, feeling the ground move in a minor tremor was commonplace, but she had never really gotten used to it. And when she felt the earth shake or saw television pictures of collapsed buildings, the dread that crept through her veins like a drug was not the fear of being crushed or burned, but the blind panic of a little girl whose world suddenly started to fall apart. She was still on edge that evening as she walked into the sophisticated ambience of Moss's, wearing a black silk sheath and the row of pearls Don Riley had given her the Christmas they were living together. Don ordered a white burgundy called Corton Charlemagne. He drank most of it. Judy loved the nutty taste, but she was not comfortable drinking alcohol when she had a semi-automatic pistol loaded with 9mm ammunition tucked into her black patent evening purse. She told Don that Brian Kincaid had accepted her apology and allowed her to withdraw her resignation. "He had to," Don said. "Refusing would be tantamount to firing you, and it would look real bad for him if he lost one of his best people on his first day as acting sack." "Maybe you're right," Judy said, but she was thinking that it was easy for Don to be wise after the event. "Sure I'm right. Remember, Brian is KMA. It stood for Kiss My Ass, and it meant the person had built up such a generous pension entitlement that he could retire comfortably at any time that suited him. "Yeah, but he has his pride. Imagine where he explains to headquarters how come he had to let you go. 'She said fuck to me,' he says. Washington goes, 'So what are you, a priest? You never heard an agent say fuck before?' Uh-uh." Don shook his head. "Kincaid would seem like a wimp to refuse your apology." "I guess so. Anyway, I'm real glad we may be working together again soon." He raised his glass. "Here's to many more brilliant prosecutions by the great team of Riley and Maddox." She clinked glasses and took a sip of wine. They talked over the cases they ate, recalling the mistakes they had made, the surprises they had sprung on the defense, the moments of tension and triumph. When they were drinking coffee, Don said, "Do you miss me?" Judy frowned. It would be cruel to say no, and anyway it was not true. But she did not want to give him false encouragement. "I miss some things," she said. "I like you when you're funny and smart." She also missed having a warm body beside her at night, but she was not going to tell him that. He said, "I miss talking about my work and hearing about yours." "I guess I talk to Beau now." "I miss him, too. He likes you. He thinks you're the ideal husband." I am. "For someone in law enforcement." Don shrugged. "I'll settle for that." Judy grinned. "Maybe you and Beau should get married." "Ho, ho." He paid the bill. "Judy, there's something I want to say." "I'm listening." "I think I'm ready to be a father." For some reason that angered her. "So what am I supposed to do about it? Shout hooray and open my legs?" He was taken aback. I mean, I thought you wanted commitment." "Commitment? Don, all I asked was that you refrain from stooping your secretary, but you couldn't manage that." He looked mortified. "Okay, don't get mad. I'm just trying to tell you that I've changed." "And now I'm supposed to come running back to you as if nothing had happened?"
I guess I still don't understand you.
You probably never will.
His evident distress softened her. Come on, I'll drive you home. When they were living together, she had always been the after-dinner driver. They left the restaurant in an awkward silence. In the car, he said, I thought we might at least talk about it.
Don, the lawyer, negotiating.
We can talk.
But how can I tell you that my heart is cold?
What happened with Paula? It was the worst mistake of my whole life.
She believed him. He was not drunk, just mellow enough to say what he felt. She sighed. She wanted him to be happy. She was fond of him, and she hated to see him in pain. It hurt her, too. Part of her wished she could give him what he wanted.
He said, "We had some good times together."
He stroked her thigh through the silk dress.
She said, "If you feel me up while I'm driving, I'll throw you out of the car."
He knew she could do it.
"Whatever you say."
He took his hand away. A moment later, she wished she had not been so harsh. It was not such a bad thing to have a man's hand on your thigh. Don was not the world's greatest lover. He was enthusiastic, but unimaginative. However, he was better than nothing, and nothing was what she had had since she'd left him.
"Why don't I have a man? I don't want to grow old alone. Is there something wrong with me?"
"Hell no." A minute later, she pulled up outside his building.
"Thanks, Don," she said, "for a great prosecution and a great dinner."
He leaned over to kiss her. She offered her cheek, but he kissed her lips, and she did not want to make a big thing of it, so she let him. His kiss lingered until she broke away. Then he said, "Come in for a while. I'll make you a cappuccino."
The longing look in his eyes almost broke her will. How hard could it be? She asked herself. She could put her gun in his safe, drink a large, heartwarming brandy, and spend the night in the arms of a decent man who adored her.
"No," she said firmly. "Good night."
He stared at her for a long moment, misery in his eyes. She looked back, embarrassed and sorry, but resolute.
"Good night," he said at last.
He got out and closed the car door. Judy pulled away. When she glanced in the rearview mirror, she saw him standing on the sidewalk, his hand half raised in a kind of wave. She ran a red light and turned a corner, then at last she felt alone again. When she got home, Beau was watching Conan O'Brien and chuckling. "This guy breaks me up," he said. They watched his monologue until the commercial break, then Beau turned off the TV. "I solved a murder today," he said. "How about that?"
Judy knew he had several unsolved cases on his desk.
"Which one?"
"The Telegraph Hill rape murder."
"Who did it?"
"A guy who's already in jail. He was arrested a while back for harassing young girls in the park."
"I had a hunch about him and searched his apartment. He had a pair of police handcuffs like the ones found on the body, but he denied the murder, and I couldn't break him. Today I got his DNA test back from the lab. It matches the semen from the victim's body. I told him that, and he confessed. Jackpot."
"Well done."
She kissed the top of his head.
"How about you?"
"Well, I still have a job, but it remains to be seen whether I have a career."
"You have a career. Come on."
"I don't know. If I get demoted for putting the Fung brothers in jail, what will they do to me when I have a failure?"
"You've suffered a setback. It's just temporary. You'll get over it, I promise."
She smiled, remembering the time she had thought there was nothing her father could not do.
"Well, I didn't make much progress with my case."
"Last night you thought it was a bullshit assignment anyway."
"Today I'm not so sure. The linguistic analysis showed that these people are dangerous, whoever they are."
"But they can't trigger an earthquake."
"I don't know."
Beau raised his eyebrows.
"You think it's possible?"
"I've spent most of today trying to find out. I spoke to 3 seismologists and got 3 different answers."
"Scientists are like that."
"What I really wanted was for them to tell me firmly it couldn't happen. But one said it was unlikely, one said the possibility was vanishingly small, and the third said it could be done with a nuclear bomb."
"Could these people, what are they called?"
the Hammer of Eden.
Could they have a nuclear device?
It's possible. They're smart, focused, serious.
But then why would they talk about earthquakes? Why not just threaten us with their bomb?
Yeah, Beau said thoughtfully. That would be just as terrifying and a lot more credible.
But who can tell how these people's minds work?
What's your next step?
I have one more seismologist to see, a Michael Quirkus. The others all say he's kind of a maverick, but he's the leading authority on what causes earthquakes.
She had already tried to interview Quirkus. Late that afternoon, she had rung his doorbell. He had told her through the entry phone to call for an appointment.
Maybe you didn't hear me, she said. This is the FBI.
Does that mean you don't have to make appointments?
She had cursed under her breath. She was a law enforcement officer, not a damn replacement window salesperson.
It does generally, she said into the intercom. Most people feel our work is too important to wait.
No, they don't, he replied. Most people are scared of you. That's why they let you in without an appointment. Call me. I'm in the phone book.
I'm here as a matter of public safety, Professor. I've been told you're an expert who can give me crucial information that will help in our work of protecting people. I'm sorry I didn't have the opportunity of calling for an appointment, but now that I'm here, I would really appreciate it if you would see me for a few minutes.
There was no reply, and she realized he had hung up at his end. She had driven back to the office, fuming. She did not make appointments. Agents rarely did. She preferred to catch people off guard. Almost everyone she interviewed had something to hide. The less time they had to prepare, the more likely they were to make a revealing mistake. But Quirkus was infuriatingly correct. She had no right to barge in on him. Swallowing her pride, she had called him and made an appointment for tomorrow. She decided not to tell Beau any of this.
What I really need, she said, is someone to explain the science to me in such a way that I can make my own judgment about whether a terrorist could cause an earthquake.
And you need to find these Hammer of Eden people and bust them for making threats. Any progress there?
She shook her head. I had someone interview everyone at the Green California campaign. No one there matches the profile. None have any kind of criminal or subversive record. In fact, there's nothing suspicious about them at all.
Beau nodded. It always was unlikely the perpetrators would have told the truth about who they were. Don't be discouraged. You've only been on the case a day and a half.
True, but that leaves only 2 clear days to their deadline, and I have to go to Sacramento on Thursday to report to the governor's office.
You'd better start early tomorrow.
He got up off the couch. They both went upstairs.
Judy paused at her bedroom door. Remember that earthquake when I was 6?
He nodded. It wasn't much by California standards, but it scared you half to death.
Judy smiled. I thought it was the end of the world.
The shaking must have shifted the house a little because your bedroom door jammed shut and I nearly busted my shoulder breaking it down.
I thought it was you that made the shaking stop. I believed that for years.
Afterward, you were scared of that damn chest of drawers that your mother liked so much. You wouldn't have it in the house.
I thought it wanted to eat me.
In the end, I chopped it up for firewood.
Suddenly, Beau looked sad.
I wish I could have those years back, to live all over again.
She knew he was thinking of her mother.
Yeah, she said. Good night, kid.
Night, Beau.
As she drove across the Bay Bridge on Wednesday morning, heading for Berkeley, Judy wondered what Michael Quirkus looked like. His irritable manner suggested a peevish professor, stooped and shabby, peering irritably at the world through glasses that kept falling down his nose. Or he could be an academic fat cat in a pinstripe suit, charming to people who might donate money to the university, contemptuously indifferent to anyone who could not be of use to him. She parked in the shade of a magnolia tree on Euclid Avenue. As she rang his bell, she had a horrible feeling he might find another excuse to send her away. But when she gave her name, there was a buzz and the door opened. She climbed 2 flights to his apartment. It was open. She walked in. The place was small and cheap. His business could not be making much money. She passed through a vestibule and found herself in his office cum living room.
He was sitting at his desk in khakis, tan walking boots, and a navy blue polo shirt. Michael Quirkus was neither a peevish professor nor an academic fat cat, she saw immediately. He was a hunk, tall, fit, good-looking, with sexy hair, dark and curly. She quickly summed him up as one of those guys who were so big and handsome and confident they thought they could do anything they liked. He, too, was surprised. His eyes widened, and he said, "Are you the FBI agent?" She gave him a firm handshake. "Were you expecting someone else?" He shrugged. "You don't look like Ephraim Zimbalist, Jr." Zimbalist was the actor who played Inspector Louis Erskine in the long-running television show The FBI. Judy said mildly, "I've been an agent for 10 years. Can you imagine how many people have already made that joke?" To her surprise, he grinned broadly. "Okay," he said, "you got me." "That's better." She noticed a framed photo on his desk. It showed a pretty redhead with a child in her arms. People always like to talk about their children. "Who's this?" she said. "Nobody important. You want to get to the point?" "Forget friendly." She took him at his word and asked her question right out. "I need to know if a terrorist group could trigger an earthquake." "Have you had a threat?" "I'm supposed to be asking the questions." "You haven't heard? It's been talked about on the radio. Don't you listen to John Truth?" He shook his head. "Is it serious?" "That's what I need to establish." "Okay. Well, the short answer is yes." Judy felt a frisson of fear. Quirkus seemed so sure. She had been hoping for the opposite answer. She said, "How could they do it?" "Take a nuclear bomb, put it at the bottom of a deep mine shaft, and detonate it. That'll do the trick. But you probably want a more realistic scenario." "Yeah. Imagine you wanted to trigger an earthquake." "Oh, I could do it." Judy wondered if he was just bragging. "Explain how." "Okay." He reached down behind his desk and picked up a short plank of wood and a regular house brick. He obviously kept them there for this purpose. He put the plank on his desk and the brick on the plank. Then he lifted one end of the plank slowly until the brick slid down the slope onto the desk. "The brick slips when the gravity pulling it overcomes the friction holding it still," he said. "Okay so far?"
"Sure."
"A fault such as the San Andreas is a place where two adjacent slabs of the Earth's crust are moving in different directions. Imagine a pair of icebergs scraping past one another. They don't move smoothly, they get jammed. Then, when they're stuck, pressure builds up, slowly but surely over the decades."
"So how does that lead to earthquakes?"
"Something happens to release all that stored-up energy." He lifted one end of the plank again. This time he stopped just before the brick began to slide. "Several sections of the San Andreas Fault are like this, just about ready to slip any decade now. Take this." He handed Judy a clear plastic 12-inch ruler. "Now tap the plank sharply just in front of the brick." She did so, and the brick began to slide. Quirkus grabbed it and stopped it. "When the plank is tilted, it takes only a little tap to make the brick move. And where the San Andreas is under tremendous pressure, a little nudge may be enough to unjam the slabs. Then they slip, and all that pent-up energy shakes the earth." Quirkus might be abrasive, but once he got onto his subject, he was a pleasure to listen to. He was a clear thinker, and he explained himself easily, without condescending. Despite the ominous picture he was painting, Judy realized she was enjoying talking to him, and not just because he was so good-looking. "Is that what happens in most earthquakes?" "I believe so, though some other seismologists might disagree. There are natural vibrations that resound through the Earth's crust from time to time. Most earthquakes are probably triggered by the right vibration in the right place at the right time." "How am I going to explain all this to Mr. Honeymoon? He's going to want simple yes-no answers." "So how does that help our terrorists?"
"They need a ruler, and they need to know where to tap."
"What's the real-life equivalent of the ruler? A nuclear bomb?"
"They don't need anything so powerful. They have to send a shockwave through the Earth's crust, that's all. If they know exactly where the fault is vulnerable, they might do it with a charge of dynamite precisely placed."
Anyone can get hold of dynamite if they really want to.
The explosion would have to be underground. I guess drilling a shaft would be the challenge for a terrorist group.
Judy wondered if the blue-collar man imagined by Simon Sparrow was a drilling rig operator. Such men would surely need a special license. A quick check with the Department of Motor Vehicles might yield a list of all of them in California. There could not be many.
Quirkus went on. They would obviously need drilling equipment, expertise, and some kind of pretext to get permission.
Those problems were not insurmountable.
Is it really so simple? Judy said.
Listen, I'm not telling you this would work. I'm saying it might. No one will know for sure until they try it. I can try to give you some insight into how these things happen, but you'll have to make your own assessment of the risk.
Judy nodded. She had used almost the same words last night in telling Beau what she needed.
Quirkus might act like an asshole sometimes, but as Beau would say, everyone needed an asshole now and again.
So, knowing where to place the charge is everything?
Yes.
Who has that information?
Universities, the state geologist, me, we all share information.
Anyone can get hold of it?
It's not secret, though you would need to have some scientific knowledge to interpret the data.
So someone in the terrorist group would have to be a seismologist?
Yes, could be a student.
Judy thought of the educated 30-year-old woman who was doing the typing, according to Simon's theory. She could be a graduate student. How many geology students were there in California? How long would it take to find and interview them all?
Quirkus went on. And there's one other factor, Earth tides. The oceans move this way and that under the gravitational influence of the moon, and the solid Earth is subject to the same forces. Twice a day there's a seismic window when the fault line is under extra stress because of the tides, and that's when an earthquake is most likely, or most easy to trigger. Which is my specialty. I'm the only person who has done extensive calculations of seismic windows for California faults.
Could someone have gotten this data from you?
Well, I'm in the business of selling it. He gave a rueful smile. But as you can see, my business isn't making me rich. I have one contract with a big insurance company, and that pays the rent, but unfortunately that's all. My theories about seismic windows make me kind of a maverick, and corporate America hates mavericks.
The note of wry self-deprecation was surprising, and Judy started to like him better.
Someone might have taken the information without your knowledge. Have you been burgled lately?
Never.
Could your data have been copied by a friend or relative?
I don't think so. No one spends time in this room without my being here.
She picked up the photo from his desk.
Your wife or girlfriend?
He looked annoyed and took the picture out of her hand.
I'm separated from my wife, and I don't have a girlfriend.
Is that so? Said Judy.
She had got everything she needed from him. She stood up.
I appreciate your time, Professor.
Please, call me Michael. I've enjoyed talking to you.
She was surprised.
He added, You pick up fast. That makes it more fun.
Well, good.
He walked her to the door of the apartment and shook her hand. He had big hands, but his grip was surprisingly gentle.
Anything else you want to know, I'll be glad to help.
She risked a jibe.
So long as I call ahead for an appointment, right?
He did not smile.
Right.
Driving back across the bay, she reflected that the danger was now clear. A terrorist group might conceivably be able to cause an earthquake. They would need accurate data on critically stressed points on the fault line, and perhaps on seismic windows, but that was obtainable. They had to have someone to interpret the data, and they needed some way to send shockwaves through the earth. That would be the most difficult task, but it was not out of the question. She had the unwelcome task of telling the governor's aide that the whole thing was horrifyingly possible.
Chapter 5 Priest woke at first light on Thursday. He generally woke early, all the year round. He never needed much sleep unless he had been partying too hard, and that was rare now.
One more day.
From the governor's office there had been nothing but a maddening silence. They acted as if no threat had been made. So did the rest of the world, by and large. The Hammer of Eden was rarely mentioned in the news broadcasts Priest listened to on his car radio.
Only John Truth took them seriously. He kept taunting Governor Mike Robeson in his daily radio show. Until yesterday, all the governor would say was that the FBI was investigating. But last night, Truth had reported that the governor had promised a statement today. That statement would decide everything. If it was conciliatory and gave at least a hint that the governor would consider the demand, Priest would rejoice. But if the statement was unyielding, Priest would have to cause an earthquake. He wondered if he really could. Melanie sounded convincing when she talked about the fault line and what it would take to make it slip, but no one had ever tried this. Even she admitted she could not be 100% sure it would work. What if it failed? What if it worked and they were caught? What if it worked and they were killed in the earthquake? Who would take care of the communards and the children? He rolled over. Melanie's head lay on the pillow beside him. He studied her face in repose. Her skin was very white, and her eyelashes were almost transparent. A strand of long ginger-colored hair fell across her cheek. He pulled the sheet back a little and looked at her breasts, heavy and soft. He contemplated waking her. Under the covers, he reached out and stroked her, running his hand across her belly and into the triangle of reddish hair below. She stirred, swallowed, then turned over and moved away. He sat up. He was in the one-room house that had been his home for the last 25 years. As well as the bed, it had an old couch in front of the fireplace and a table in the corner with a fat yellow candle in a holder. There was no electric light. In the early days of the commune, most people lived in cabins like this, and the kids all slept in a bunkhouse. But over the years, some permanent couples had formed, and they had built bigger places with separate bedrooms for their children. Priest and Star had kept their own individual houses, but the trend was against them. It was best not to fight the inevitable. Priest had learned that from Star. Now there were 6 family homes as well as the original 15 cabins. Right now, the commune consisted of 25 adults and 10 children, plus Melanie and Dusty. 1 cabin was empty. This room was as familiar as his hand, but lately the well-known objects had taken on a new aura. For years, his eye had passed over without registering them. The picture of Priest that Star had painted for his 30th birthday, the elaborately decorated hookah left behind by a French girl called Marie Louise, the rickety shelf Flower had made in woodwork class, the fruit crate in which he kept his clothes. Now that he knew he might have to leave, each homely item looked special and wonderful, and it brought a lump to his throat to look at them. His room was like a photograph album in which every picture unchained a string of memories. The birth of Ringo, the day Smiler nearly drowned in the river, making love to twin sisters called Jane and Eliza, the warm, dry autumn of their first grape harvest, the taste of the 89 vintage. When he looked around and thought of the people who wanted to take it all away from him, he was filled with a rage that burned inside him like vitriol in his belly. He picked up a towel, stepped into his sandals, and went outside naked. His dog, Spirit, greeted him with a quiet snuffle. It was a clear, crisp morning with patches of high cloud in the blue sky. The sun had not yet appeared over the mountains, and the valley was in shadow. No one else was about. He walked downhill through the little village, and Spirit followed. Although the communal spirit was still strong, people had customized their homes with individual touches. One woman had planted the ground around her house with flowers and small shrubs. Priest had named her Garden in consequence. Dale and Poem, who were a couple, had let their children paint the outside walls, and the result was a colorful mess. A man called Slow, who was retarded, had built a crooked porch on which stood a wobbly homemade rocking chair. Priest knew the place might not be beautiful to other eyes. The paths were muddy, the buildings were rickety, and the layout was haphazard. There was no zoning. The kids' bunkhouse was right next to the wine barn, and the carpentry yard was in the midst of the cabins. The privies were moved every year to no avail. No matter where they were sited, you could always smell them on a hot day. Yet everything about the place warmed his heart. And when he looked farther away and saw the forested hillside soaring steeply from the gleaming river all the way to the blue peaks of the Sierra Nevada, he had a view that was so beautiful it hurt. But now, every time he looked at it, the thought that he might lose it stabbed him like a knife. Beside the river, a wooden box on a boulder held soap, cheap razors, and a hand mirror. He lathered his face and shaved, then stepped into the cold stream and washed all over. He dried himself briskly on the coarse towel. There was no piped water here. In winter, when it was too cold to bathe in the river, they had a communal bath night twice a week and heated great barrels of water in the cookhouse to wash one another. It was quite sexy. But in summer, only babies had warm water. He went back up the hill and dressed quickly in the blue jeans and work shirt he always wore. He walked over to the cookhouse and stepped inside. The door was not locked. No doors had locks here. He built up the fire with logs and lit it, put on a pan of water for coffee, and went out. He liked to walk around when the others were all abed. He whispered their names as he passed their homes. Moon, Chocolate, Giggle. He imagined each one lying there, sleeping. Apple, a fat girl, lying on her back with her mouth open, snoring. Juice and Alaska, two middle-aged women entwined together. The kids in the bunkhouse. His own Flower, Ringo and Smiler. Melanie's Dusty. The twins, Bubble and Chip, all pink cheeks and tousled hair. My people, may they live here forever. He passed the workshop, where they kept spades and hoes and pruning shears, the concrete circle where they trod the grapes in October, and the barn, where the wine from last year's harvest stood in huge wooden casks, slowly settling and clarifying, now almost ready to be blended and bottled. He paused outside the temple. He felt very proud. From the very beginning they had talked of building a temple. For many years it had seemed an impossible dream. There was always too much else to do, land to clear and vines to plant, barns to build, the vegetable garden and the free shop and the kids' lessons. But 5 years ago the commune had seemed to reach a plateau. For the first time, Priest was not worried about whether they would have enough to eat through the coming winter. He no longer felt that one bad harvest could wipe them out. There was nothing undone on the list of urgent tasks he carried in his head. So he had announced that it was time to build the temple. And here it was. It meant a lot to Priest. It showed that his community was mature. They were not living hand-to-mouth anymore. They could feed themselves and have time and resources to spare for building a place of worship. They were no longer a bunch of hippies trying out an idealistic dream. The dream worked. They had proved it. The temple was the emblem of their triumph. He stepped inside. It was a simple wooden structure with a single skylight and no furniture. Everyone sat cross-legged in a circle on the plank floor to worship. It was also the schoolhouse and meeting room. The only decoration was a banner Star had made. Priest could not read it, but he knew what it said. Meditation is life. All else is distraction. Money makes you poor. Marriage is the greatest infidelity. When no one owns anything, we all own everything. Do what you like is the only law. These were the five paradoxes of Bagram. Priest said he had learned them from an Indian guru he had studied under in Los Angeles, but in fact he had made them up. Pretty good for a guy who can't read. He stood in the center of the room for several minutes, eyes closed, arms hanging loosely at his sides, focusing his energy. There was nothing phony about this. He had learned meditation techniques from Star, and they really worked. He felt his mind clarify like the wine in the casks. He prayed that Governor Mike Robeson's heart would be softened, and he would announce a freeze on the building of new power plants in California. He imagined the handsome governor in his dark suit and white shirt, sitting in a leather chair behind a polished desk. And in his vision the governor said, "I have decided to give these people what they want, not just to avoid an earthquake, but because it makes sense anyway." After a few minutes, Priest's spiritual strength was renewed. He felt alert, confident, centered. When he went outside again, he decided to check on the vines. There had been no grapes originally. When Star arrived, there was nothing in the valley but a ruined hunting lodge. For 3 years, the commune had lurched from crisis to crisis, riven by quarrels, washed out in storms, sustained only by begging trips to towns. Then Priest came. It took him less than a year to become Star's acknowledged equal as joint leader. First he had organized the begging trips for maximum efficiency. They would hit a town like Sacramento or Stockton on a Saturday morning when the streets were crowded with shoppers. Each individual would be assigned a different corner. Everyone had to have a pitch. Aneth would say she was trying to get the bus fare home to her folks in New York. Song would strum her guitar and sing There But For Fortune. Slow would say he had not eaten for 3 days. Bones would make people smile with a sign saying, Why lie? It's for beer. But begging was only a stopgap. Under Priest's direction, the hippies had terraced the hillside, diverted a brook for irrigation, and planted a vineyard. The tremendous team effort made them into a strongly knit group, and the wine enabled them to live without begging. Now their Chardonnay was sought after by connoisseurs. Priest walked along the neat rows. Herbs and flowers were planted between the vines, partly because they were useful and pretty, but mainly to attract ladybugs and wasps that would destroy green flies and other pests. No chemicals were used here. They relied on natural methods. They grew clover, too, because it fixed nitrogen from the air, and when they plowed it into the soil, it acted as a natural fertilizer.
This book is continued on Disc 4. Disc 4.
They grew clover, too, because it fixed nitrogen from the air, and when they plowed it into the soil, it acted as a natural fertilizer. The vines were sprouting. It was late May, so the annual peril of frost killing the new shoots was past. At this point in the cycle, most of the work consisted of tying the shoots to trellises to train their growth and prevent wind damage. Priest had learned about wine during his years as a liquor wholesaler, and Starr had studied the subject in books. But they could not have succeeded without old Raymond de la Valle, a good-natured wine grower who helped them because, Priest guessed, he wished his own youth had been more daring. Priest's vineyard had saved the commune, but the commune had saved Priest's life. He had arrived here a fugitive, on the run from the mob, the Los Angeles police, and the Internal Revenue Service all at once. He was a drunk and a cocaine abuser, lonely, broke, and suicidal. He had driven down the dirt road to the commune, following vague directions from a hitchhiker, and wandered through the trees until he came upon a bunch of naked hippies sitting on the ground chanting. He had stared at them for a long while, spellbound by the mantra and the sense of profound calm that rose up like smoke from a fire. One or two had smiled at him, but they had continued their ritual. Eventually he had stripped off, slowly, like a man in a trance, discarding his business suit, pink shirt, platform shoes, and red and white jockey shorts. Then, naked, he had sat down with them. Here he had found peace, a new religion, work, friends, and lovers. At a time when he was ready to drive his yellow Plymouth Cuda 446 right over the edge of a cliff, the commune had given meaning to his life. Now there would never be any other existence for him. This place was all he had, and he would die to defend it. I may have to. He would listen to John Truth's radio show tonight. If the governor was going to open the door to negotiation or make any other concession, it would surely be announced before the end of the broadcast. When he came to the far side of the vineyard, he decided to check on the seismic vibrator. He walked up the hill. There was no road, just a well-trodden path through the forest. Vehicles could not get through to the village. A quarter of a mile from the houses, he arrived at a muddy clearing. Parked under the trees were his old Cuda, a rusty Volkswagen minibus that was even older, Melanie's orange Subaru, and the communal pickup, a dark green Ford Ranger. From here, a dirt track wound 2 miles through the forest, uphill and down, disappearing into a mudslide here and passing through a stream there, until at last it reached the county road, a 2-lane blacktop. It was 10 miles to the nearest town, Silver City. Once a year, the entire commune would spend a day rolling barrels of wine up the hill and through the trees to this clearing, there to be loaded onto Paul Beale's truck for transport to his bottling plant in Napa. It was the big day in their calendar, and they always held a feast that night, then took a holiday on the following day to celebrate a successful year. The ceremony took place 8 months after the harvest, so it was due in a few days' time. This year, Priest resolved, they would hold the party the day after the governor reprieved the valley. In return for the wine, Paul Beale brought food for the communal kitchen and kept the free shop stocked with supplies, Clothing, candy, cigarettes, stationery, books, tampons, toothpaste, everything anyone needed. The system operated without money. However, Paul kept accounts, and at the end of each year he deposited surplus cash in a bank account that only Priest and Starr knew about. From the clearing, Priest headed along the track for a mile, skirting rainwater pools and clambering over deadfalls, then turned off and followed an invisible way through the trees. There were no tire tracks because he had carefully brushed the carpet of pine needles that formed the forest floor. He came to a hollow and stopped. All he could see was a pile of vegetation, broken branches and uprooted saplings heaped 12 feet high like a bonfire. He had to go right up to the pile and push aside some of the brush to confirm that the truck was still there under its camouflage. Not that he thought anyone would come here looking for the truck. The Ricky Granger, who had been hired as a juggy by Ritkin Seismex in the South Texas oil field, had no traceable connection with this remote vineyard in Sierra County, California. However, it did occasionally happen that a couple of backpackers would lose their way radically and wander onto the commune's land, as Melanie had, and they would sure as hell wonder why this large piece of expensive machinery was parked out here in the woods. So Priest and the rice-eaters had slaved for 2 hours to conceal the truck. Priest was pretty sure it could not be seen, even from the air. He exposed a wheel and kicked the tire, just like the skeptical purchaser of a used car. He had killed a man for this vehicle. He thought briefly about Mario's pretty wife and kids and wondered whether they had realized yet that Mario was never coming home. Then he put the thought out of his mind. He wanted to reassure himself that the truck would be ready to go tomorrow morning. Just looking at it made him edgy. He felt a powerful urge to get going right away, today, now, just to ease the tension. But he had announced a deadline, and timing would be important. This waiting was unbearable. He thought of getting in and starting the truck just to make sure everything was okay, but that would be foolish. He was suffering from dumb nerves. The truck would be fine. He would do better to stay away and leave it alone until tomorrow. He parted another section of the covering and looked at the steel plate that hammered the earth. If Melanie's scheme worked, the vibration would unleash an earthquake. There was a pure kind of justice about the plan. They would be using the earth's stored-up energy as a threat to force the governor to take care of the environment. The earth was saving the earth. It felt right to Priest in a way that was almost holy. Spirit gave a low bark as if he had heard something. It was probably a rabbit, but Priest nervously replaced the branches he had moved, then headed back. He made his way through the trees to the track and turned toward the village. He stopped in the middle of the track and frowned, mystified. On the way here, he had stepped over a fallen bough. Now it had been moved to the side. Spirit had not been barking at rabbits. Someone else was about. He had not heard anyone, but sounds were quickly muffled in the dense vegetation. Who was it? Had someone followed him? Had they seen him looking at the seismic vibrator? As he headed home, Spirit became agitated. When they came within sight of the parking circle, Priest saw why. There in the muddy clearing, parked beside his Cuda, was a police car. Priest's heart stopped. So soon? How could they have tracked him down so soon? He stared at the cruiser. It was a white Ford Crown Victoria with a green stripe along the side, a silver six-pointed sheriff's star on the door, 4 aerials, and a rack of blue, red, and orange lights on the roof. Be calm. All things must pass. The police might not be here for the vibrator. Idle curiosity might have brought a cop wandering down the track. It had never happened before, but it was possible. There were lots of other possible reasons. They could be searching for a tourist who had gone missing. A sheriff's deputy could be looking for a secret place to meet his neighbor's wife. They might not even realize there was a commune here. Perhaps they need never find out. If Priest slipped back into the woods... Too late. Just as the thought entered his head, a cop stepped around the trunk of a tree. Spirit barked fiercely. "Quiet," Priest said, and the dog fell silent. The cop was wearing the gray-green uniform of a sheriff's deputy, with a star over the left breast of the short jacket, a cowboy hat, and a gun on his pants belt. He saw Priest and waved. Priest hesitated, then slowly raised his hand and waved back. Then, reluctantly, he walked up to the car. He hated cops, Most of them were thieves and bullies and psychopaths. They used their uniform and their position to conceal the fact that they were worse criminals than the people they arrested. But he would force himself to be polite, just as if he were some dumb suburban citizen who imagined the police were there to protect him. He breathed evenly, relaxed the muscles of his face, smiled, and said, "Howdy." The cop was alone. He was young, maybe 25 or 30, with short, light brown hair. His body in the uniform was already beefy. In 10 years' time, he would have a beer gut. "Are there any residences near here?" the cop asked. Priest was tempted to lie, but a moment's reflection told him it was too risky. The cop only had to walk a quarter of a mile in the right direction to stumble upon the houses, and his suspicions would be aroused if he found he had been lied to. So Priest told the truth. "You're not far from the Silver River Winery." "I never heard of it before." That was no accident. In the phone book, its address and number were Paul Beale's in Napa. None of the communards registered to vote. None of them paid taxes because none had any income. They had always been secretive. Starr had a horror of publicity that dated from the time the hippie movement had been destroyed by overexposure in the media. But many of the communards had a reason to hide away. Some had debts. Others were wanted by the police. Oaktree had been a deserter. Song had escaped from an uncle who sexually abused her. And Aneth's husband had beaten her up and swore that if she left him, he would seek her out wherever she might be. The commune